Well, April 17th is an even more memorable date than I realized. On this date, 50 years ago, Ford unveiled the first Mustang at the New York World's Fair, and we'll talk about the Mustang, 50 years of the Mustang, later this hour. As it turns out, on the previous day, I thought it was the same day, but it was the day before, 4/16/64, the first Rolling Stones album was released. So what made the 60s the 60s picked up a lot of steam on two consecutive days, 48 hours. And think about it, they're both still around. Welcome to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Yes, we'll talk with someone who was working at Ford on the day the Mustang was unveiled, author Michael W.R. Davis. Also later this hour, book reviewer Scott Southard reviews a Michigan notable book from this year, a collection of short stories and poems about a truly magical place, our Upper Peninsula. That and lots more coming up this hour here on Current State. To start our program, developments toward a grand bargain to speed the end of Detroit's landmark bankruptcy have been unfolding quickly the last couple of days. Late on Tuesday night, negotiators from the city and two of its retiree pension funds reached tentative deals involving cuts in cost of living revisions. Those agreements were two more hurdles cleared toward an $816 million arrangement that could lessen pension cuts, allow reinvestment in city services, and prevent the sale of city-owned art at the Detroit Institute of Arts. But more such agreements need to be hammered out with other creditors. Also today, we are learning that the state is offering to sweeten its proposal to contribute $350 million to the effort. Now, to bring us up to speed, I spoke just a short while ago with Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood. I first asked Chad to explain this latest offer from the state.
Yeah, the state, the governor Snyder has pledged $350 million in state funds towards bolstering the pensions. The money would come from the tobacco settlement fund. It's just been kind of a question of how the money would arrive, and the state has reportedly offered to put all the money up front, where the state would probably take out a bond on the money. In the equivalent value of $350 over 20 years, it might be less than $350 million, but it will be what would equate to the same amount of money if you made $17.5 million payments every year for the next two decades. So that's really kind of sweetened the deal a little bit for the pensioners, because that puts the money directly in the pension funds, and they can then grow at a rate about 6.75% on the investment return. That gives the pension funds more money up front right now.
Does that suggest increasing support at the Capitol for the state's role in this?
Not sure how that's going to play out at the Capitol. I mean, there's one side of it that says the state would be taking out debt, essentially, and securitized by the tobacco settlement funds. And what I mean by securitized is that the tobacco settlement funds would be the secure source of repayment on that debt. But at the same time, it also is, if it's part of the whole bargain, as part of the deal to get the bankruptcy settled in a timely, quick fashion before the fall elections, and at the same time get the state off the hook possibly for unpaid pensions, then the legislature might want to act quickly on this.
The agreements between the city and the pension funds from late Tuesday were described yesterday as tentative. Are those still intact?
Yeah, the agreements essentially are the general retirement system employees, anybody who is non-uniform in the city, will get a 4.5% reduction in their base pension, and the elimination of annual cost of living increases, or COLA. And then the police and firefighters, they're getting out of this relatively unscathed. They're going to have essentially their COLA, which is about 2.25%, compounds every year, adds to the value of their pension. That's going to be cut in half by 55% to just around 1%. So that's the General Retirement Systems Board yesterday met and voted and unanimously approved endorsing this plan. And the Police and Firefighters Retirement System Board is scheduled to meet this morning and potentially endorse it as well.
Clarify for us, please, Chad, how many more similar agreements are still needed before everybody's on board?
Well, there's a couple of big holdouts, and it is unclear whether they really will come in from the cold, so to speak. And these are bond insurers. These are companies that have insured Detroit debt, and they either are general obligation bonds with limited taxes to support them, or they are these complicated, kind of toxic bonds that the city took out to prop up its pension fund in 2005 and 2006. On what's known as certificates of participation, kind of IOUs, basically. And the insurers of those bonds are essentially facing total wipeout or at best getting a 20 cent on the dollar recovery. So they're the biggest holdout still in this whole equation. But I'm not certain at this point that they're really going to be getting any kind of a good deal like the pensioners have been getting here. And frankly, there is some sentiment in Detroit that those are institutions that that loan Detroit money. They kind of should have known better that the city was sort of a financial basket case and ended into a free fall. There's just little sympathy for New York bond insurers.
We'll remind our listeners that this grand bargain would give the city $816 million earmarked for pensions. The money would come from 12 private foundations, the state, and Detroit Institute of Art donors. In return, the DIA's art collection, which is owned by the city, would not be sold. Chad, you wrote that the pension agreements from late Tuesday that are still on the table were much less severe than what was originally proposed. What has changed there?
There's a couple of factors. There has been new money, obviously, between the grand bargain money, but also these pension funds over the last 2 years have been posting double digit returns, and because of that, they got more money on the table. And there, a lot of this is there's some mathematical equations that are being changed. You can essentially make numbers do what you want at times, and the same applies to actuaries who adjust pension liabilities and forecasts.
Yeah.
At the same time, there has been negotiating power by the city. The city has had this hammer in its hand, and it's the judge's ruling from December that pensions were like any other contract and could be cut in bankruptcy court, and didn't have the state constitutional protection didn't reside inside bankruptcy court. So they have kind of held this over their heads that if you don't take this grand bargain and if you don't give up this legal fight, then you're going to face more severe cuts. I mean, it is kind of amazing that we went from a 26% cut for general retirees just 2 weeks ago to 4.5%.
Indeed.
And 6%, it was originally proposed a 6% cut for the if the police and firefighters took the deal. Now they're going to get 0% cut and just half their COLA shaved off. And so it is kind of a, and that's one issue that's going to be probably still debated, that these bond insurers who are probably not going to get their way, they're going to come into this trial likely in July and try to pick apart this pension deal and other deals that have been done with other creditor groups, because they're going to try to prove that and have their financial people look at it and say, look, this is the city trying to cut bait and get out of bankruptcy court and avoid a huge, long, protracted legal battle. These adjustments to the pensions aren't enough. and will not, you know, will not keep this, the city from falling in the tank again, essentially. And that's that goes to the question of feasibility. Is this plan really feasible? Will the city emerge with less debt and burden so they can focus on core services? And that's going to be really the main event this summer when Judge Stephen Rhodes has to examine this whole deal.
Is that Judge Rhodes' call in the end?
Yes. Yes, it is his call on whether the plan is feasible, and it's also his call on whether the plan is fair and equitable to creditors. Now, there'll also be an argument that, look, by the bond insurers who are insuring unsecured debt, that the pensioners, also unsecured debtors, creditors, should not be getting a better deal than them. That they will argue that there's a fairness issue.
Hmm.
But like I said before, the sympathy of the faceless bond insurer or bond holder versus the faces of and plight of pensioners is hard to overcome.
We're talking with Chad Livengood of the Detroit News about the latest developments in the Detroit bankruptcy situation. There have been deadlines established as part of this process, and some of them have already been missed. Do deadlines still exist here?
Deadlines are kind of flexible in this process, it seems. I mean, at times there are some hard deadlines, and sometimes there's the city is putting out, you know, sort of self-imposed deadline. They were going to file a new amended plan of adjustment on Monday. They made that clear last week. It was frankly kind of a negotiating tactic to say, if you want to get in on the plan, you better cut a deal now. And then they didn't file that. That Monday came and went. Tuesday came and went. And then that plan got dropped in my lap at about 5 p.m. last night.
You're back in Judge Stephen Rhodes' courtroom today. What important business will be addressed there today?
Yeah, the hearing today is about the adequacy of what's called the disclosure statement. It's about a 670-page document. Got amended last night. And it essentially lays out in a very almost narrative and descriptive detail the treatment of pensioners, the treatment of retiree health care, the treatment of other creditor claims, and the city's plan to pump about $1.5 billion into reinvesting in city services over the next decade. It's the document that will go out on a CD-ROM form because they have to send, like, you know, bundles of paper. It'll be going out to 63,000. I'm losing a number in my head right now, but some odd creditors who are eligible to vote on the plan, and this will begin May 1st. They'll get this solicitation packet in the mail from the city, and this will be retirees with pensions. This will be bondholders of all sorts of stripes, and so the hearing is on whether this document has all the appropriate information and is sufficient. And there are some holes still in the thing, frankly, and so that'll be probably debated today. There's also another issue that's coming up in court today that deals with the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, and the city has essentially walked away and given up on the idea of creating a regional authority to manage the water department and essentially to try to milk some money out of it every year because it's been wholly rejected essentially by Oakland and Macomb County. And so Wayne County has stepped in and said they want to have a mediation on these negotiations. And so they're asking a judge today to appoint a special mediator to get all sides in the room because this issue has become kind of a butting of heads of egos here.
Chad Livengood covers the state legislature and the Detroit bankruptcy for the Detroit News. Lots to keep straight here, Chad. You've helped us a lot. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Mm-hmm.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Michigan Veterans Trust Fund helps combat-era U.S. veterans weather economic emergencies. The fund operates within the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. The director of the agency, Jeff Barnes, recently appointed U.S. Marine veteran Lindell Holm to run the trust fund. Holm served in the Marine Corps for 25 years and has been awarded numerous medals, including the Meritorious Service Medal. Lindell Holm joins us today to tell us about his career and his plans for helping Michigan veterans cope with their economic problems. Welcome to Current State, Lindell.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start with some background on the trust fund itself. It's designed to help U.S. combat veterans when they face emergency financial hardship. Can you explain what sorts of emergencies are we typically talking about?
Well, you're seeing a lot, especially recently with the hard winter. So there's a lot of like the energy to heat their home, you know, fuel oil costs and things like that. There's also people who just have you know, a hardship that causes them to get set back a little bit in their day-to-day living expenses, whether it be mortgage, perhaps a car payment, car insurance, things of that nature, that where they'll be able to get back on their feet if they just have a little bit of assistance to get them through this emergency situation. And of course, we've dealt with issues such as dental problems as well, medical issues. We do try to, you know, see if the we are the source of last, the last resource, so to speak. So we try to make sure that other sources have been exhausted, but we want to be there for the veteran when they have that emergency, and we come through.
But there obviously there are emergencies that are not necessarily directly related to their service.
That's correct.
That's all kinds of emergencies.
That's correct.
If it involves finances, anyway.
For example, we've had we've helped some of the younger veterans who are attending school, and they've applied for their GI Bill benefits, but they're not arriving in a timely manner. So they have housing expenses while they're attending school, and the fund has come through to provide them assistance in that area so they can until their GI Bill benefits catch up with them. We had a Vietnam era veteran who had severe dental problems. It was teeth were falling out, hadn't been able to chew in years, and he, you know, applied to receive a grant. Was deemed eligible, and we provided that dental assistance. And he wrote us back. But in his words, you know, he said that we saved his life, and you know, his health problems were that severe. And so it's just great to be able to provide that kind of assistance.
I'm sure. Yeah. Are these grants or loans? I mean, is there a responsibility on the part of the veteran who gets help from the fund to pay it back?
No, these are grants.
These are grants. Okay. But veterans are expected to show that they'll be able to meet their future expenses after meeting a grant. Is that a condition here?
That's correct.
Okay. In last year, 2013, the fund awarded grants to 1,800 veterans. That's a lot of financial emergencies. The grants totaled $2.3 million with 1,800 grants awarded. How many were many turned down?
Well, there are, yes, there are some that are turned down. I wouldn't describe it as many, but you know, there's oftentimes financial considerations. So if the board feels that there are financial, that the veteran has financial resources that he should be able to pay these bills, then, you know, that we want to be wise and frugal with our money, as well as, you know, find that balance between being wise stewards of the money, but also trying to help the veteran whenever we can.
In some cases, hardship really isn't demonstrated. In a few.
In a few.
Some of those, yeah.
And then it also, if it's a long-term situation where we, by providing assistance this month, it doesn't solve the situation for the veteran and it's more of a long-term situation, then, you know, that's not what the trust fund is intended for.
Okay. Where does the grant money come from?
Well, after World War II, the state of Michigan had established a $50 million trust fund for this purpose. And the interest off of that trust fund is what is used to provide assistance to these combat-era veterans.
Is there a dollar limit on the size of an individual grant?
at the county level, and every application starts out at the county level, the counties are able to grant up to $2,000. So any request over $2,000 goes up to the state level.
Okay. Can you explain the qualification requirement? Is it wounded veterans only? Are there conditions like that?
No. The eligibility criteria is that the veteran must have served 180 days of active duty during a wartime period, wartime era. There's, in addition to that, if it was not during a wartime era, it could be as long as they received the Armed Forces Services Medal, Armed Services Expeditionary Medal. And then as long as it's, again, 180 days, or if they were discharged because of a physical or a mental injury while serving on active duty.
Tell us about the application process. I guess you've already said $2,000, up to $2,000, you go through the county. Above $2,000, you go through the state. Where do people go? What do they do?
There is a Michigan Veterans Trust Fund resource at every county level. And usually we work closely with the county services officers who will provide assist the veteran in getting their application filled out and submitting it. And then there's a committee at the county level which will review those applications. And again, they can grant up to $2,000. If the request is above $2,000 or if the county committee denies the application, then those will go up to the state board for review. There's a 7-member board at the state level appointed by the governor, and they will review all denials and consider any appeals as well as any requests over $2,000.
How do you feel about your new job?
I really enjoy it. I really enjoy it. It's great going.
You've been at it for how long?
1 month today.
Oh.
So
just got on board.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
This must be awfully gratifying. 25 years in the Corps. And now doing this, what have you learned in the first month?
Well, I've learned that the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency and the trust fund people are just great people who are very talented and who are truly have a passion for helping veterans. It's been neat to see that, neat to see the vision and the drive that's going on there. And I'm excited about being a part of this agency and part of the being able to head up the trust fund.
We had Jeff Barnes on the show not too awful long ago. He seems like a good guy to be working for.
He's a great visionary and a great man. You know, even though he was in the Army, you know, I still can respect that man. He's definitely my brothers in the Army have done a great job, and he's a fine example for them.
You received the Meritorious Service Medal among others. Tell us about your service.
I spent, as I said, 25 years in the Marine Corps. I was trained as a CH-53E helicopter pilot, and so got the opportunity to fly that. It's the largest, most powerful helicopter that the U.S. Produces. And
did you fly one in Iraq or Afghanistan or Kuwait?
Yes, I was in Afghanistan in 2004. That was certainly the highlight of my career, and had a great opportunity there.
Where in the country were you?
Up in Bagram, so up in that northeastern
okay.
part of the country.
And you were there for how long?
7 months.
7 months. Describe what you saw in 7 months, if you would.
Well, it's a very great place to do that type of flying, a heavy lift helicopter that we have, so that we had high mountains, and it was very challenging flying. Our primary mission was to resupply the forward operating bases. I did get some a little bit of excitement going in on some raids on occasion, but our primary mission was doing the resupply, and the Marines and the Army that were out there, they had a tough job to do because they had a lot of ground to cover, and they were out there making it happen, and that's what we provide support for that.
Are your helicopter flying days over?
Yes, they are, unfortunately. Okay. That was definitely a blast, though.
Well, we wish you well in your new endeavor. Lindell Holm is the new head for 1 month of the Michigan Veterans Trust Fund. Best of luck and good luck.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan State University is home to the nation's first publicly funded osteopathic medical school in the country. And that got Current State's Joe Lindstroth wondering just what was the difference between a DO and an MD, and he's here to tell us more. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark.
So MSU, I know MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine is also the top-ranked school of its kind in the nation. Isn't that right?
That is correct. That is correct. And with MSU's top ranking and its groundbreaking investment back in the 70s in the medical school, I was just curious to know more about what makes an osteopathic doctor different from a traditional MD. It's likely we'll be seeing a lot more DOs across the state in the coming years, as the college expects to play a key role in addressing Michigan's physician shortage, which is expected to rise 4,000 to 5,000 physicians by the year 2020. So I recently spoke with Dr. William Strample, who's the dean of the Michigan State College of Osteopathic Medicine, and I asked him to tell me just what distinguishes an osteopathic physician.
We train our people to touch people. I mean, when you come into, I'm a pulmonologist, a pulmonary specialist. When you come in to see me, yeah, I can put a stethoscope on you and I can say this, you have asthma or you don't or whatever. But we actually train our physicians to actually look at all the things. We look at a holistic concept of healthcare, and we've done that for about 144 years in the United States.
How does the training differ for a DO, an osteopathic doctor, as opposed to an MD?
The training difference is in the basic science courses, microbiology, physiology, anatomy, all are the same. Okay, essentially we do all that. But we add to that from the very beginning, first day of medical school. They begin to learn manual medicine concepts and they begin to learn doctor-patient relationship skills. And we actually teach within our first year, the students learn how to do a complete physical exam on everybody. So our students, by the time they're finished with their freshman year, are already examining patients.
MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine was founded in 1970. And
actually, it was founded as a private school in Pontiac, probably 1968, 69. It originally came into being because the osteopathic physicians in the state of Michigan in 1964 decided they wanted an osteopathic medical school here. So all the physicians, all the DO physicians in the state of Michigan, 1964, got together, and with the state organization, they decided to tax themselves $2,000 a year for 5 years for everybody physician in the state.
Starting in 64.
64, and they built up a fund to start the college. To give you that in perspective, in 1964, you could buy a brand new Thunderbird convertible for $1,700. So $2,000 would be the equivalent today of every physician in the profession deciding to tax themselves $50,000 a year for 5 years. So that was a real commitment.
That's very significant. What was the motivation behind that?
They wanted an osteopathic college in Michigan. The original osteopathic college was in Kirksville, Missouri. And then the four others that started, Kansas City, Des Moines, Iowa, Chicago, and Philadelphia, are all still in existence. Michigan State was essentially the sixth College of Osteopathic Medicine, and when it was started as a private school in Pontiac, that was what we thought. But then politics in the state, Governor Milliken's office, they decided they wanted Michigan State, the College of Osteopathic Medicine, to be a state-supported school. And by public act, and I believe it's 1679, they moved Michigan State College of Osteopathic Medicine to the university. And it became a full part of Michigan State University by state law, actually.
Just how groundbreaking was this?
Well, in the osteopathic profession, it was the first osteopathic medical school that was actually funded by the state, essentially. It got state funding. Prior to that, every other osteopathic school was a private school. And Michigan State University was groundbreaking. when we came here to Michigan State, it caused an explosion across the United States. There are now 32 osteopathic medical schools in the country in about 36 different locations, and the majority of them are at major universities.
You received your DO degree in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose osteopathic medicine?
Well, a friend of ours and my local family physician was an MD and a DO working in the same office together. And I'll never forget it because he pulled me aside one day and he said, listen, why don't you go talk to one of the osteopathic things colleges? And I said, okay. I didn't even know at that point what it was. And so he recommended Chicago because at that time it was the number one school in the profession. No longer. Michigan State is now, okay, to do that.
Any winks,
that's right. We are, but by the U.S. News and World Report and all those things. But so I went to Chicago, and I'll never forget it because it was the only interview I had in any of the medical schools where I not only got to interview with the professor and the dean and whatever, but they had me interview with five of the students that were already going there to really ask me why I wanted to do this and what my motivation was and whatever. And it was an all-afternoon, all-day adventure. And when I came out of there, I remember talking to the guy, and he said, well, if we admit you here, we already know you've been admitted. I was admitted to another medical school, okay, to do MD school. And he said, but they know that they've got you on this six-month delay and that issue. But if you want, if we admit you here, what would your decision be? And it was a serendipitous moment. I actually looked at the guy and I said, well, I'm a believer in a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. If I'm admitted here, I'll probably come here because I can start in the next couple of months. And he stuck out his hand. He said, congratulations, you've been admitted. And my life was never the same after that point.
And prior to this whole experience, though, you didn't know much about osteopathic medicine.
Well, I knew that I had gone to an osteopathic physician, and he worked with a friend of mine, another doctor in the office, and I'd gone to both of them most of my life. And until he pointed out to me the difference in the degree and the principle, I really didn't pay much attention to it. I think that's probably the biggest weakness in that most people in Lansing have seen an osteopathic physician. Almost all of the emergency medicine physicians in town, most of the orthopedic surgeons, most of the other things are DOs, but most people don't pay much attention to it. They're their doctor to do that.
And I think that's what I wanted to ask you about, is perception. As you were doing your training, Dr. Stramble, did you run into any stigmas associated with being a DO versus being an MD?
When I got into the Army, when I got accepted and they picked me for my internship and residency at Madigan in Seattle, I went out there. I was the first DO they'd ever had in that program. In fact, I'm absolutely convinced of the 44 interns in my class, not one of them really had thought about what an osteopathic physician was. And from the Army, the thing they were interested in more, could you do it, not what your degree was. And for me, in my early years, it was, I spent some time explaining it, but I didn't have anybody reacting because they knew I could do what I could do. My training did me well.
Are there stigmas that still exist between the professions at all, or has that kind of gone away, or characterize that for me?
Is there a rub? Sure, there's always, anytime there's a dual profession, you're always going to have some people that say this or that. It's kind of like the rivalry that exists between Michigan State and that trade school down south here.
Exactly,
Harvard.
And that's what I'm trying to get at, is just
most
what are the differences
of it is. Most of it is there to do, but over the last 25 years, I think it's almost become invisible. You've had the Surgeon General of the United States Army was a DO. The physician to Congress was a DO. The physician to the White House has been a DO twice with two different administrations. So all that stuff has kind of gone by the wayside. Now, there are still going to be people. It's just like you run into people that are never going to give up whatever their prejudice is one way or the other to do that. And you can't live your life worrying about that. You do your job. And what I tell the young men and women that work in my school is you learn all the things the best you can, you do the best care you can, and you don't have to worry about anybody else. It'll take care of itself.
I'm Joe Lindstroth, and I'm speaking with Dr. William Strample. He's the dean of MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine. Dr. Strample, can you characterize our state's primary care physician shortage right now?
Well, it didn't change with the health care reform, or if you want to use the slang term, Obamacare. if you look back at the Blue Ribbon Panel in the early 2000s, the State of Michigan Blue Ribbon Panel, all of the leaders that got together were predicting a physician shortage in Michigan in primary care of 4,000 to 5,000 physicians by 2020. Healthcare reform now gets a lot of attention, and now they say the number is 6,000 or whatever. It's always been a right about that number, and many of it is not just a shortage, but it's not as big a shortage in Grand Rapids, Lansing, or Detroit. It's a distribution shortage. If you go north of Clare, you're going to find huge areas where it's very hard to get an appointment to see a physician and whatever. What we tried to do, the College of Osteopathic Medicine, when it started, was about 100 students, 125 maybe.
Back in the 70s.
In the 70s. And all the way until 1999, we were taking in 125 students. In the early 2000s, I looked at that physician shortage, and we began to look at that issue. And so I talked to the university leadership, and I talked to the accrediting agency of the medical school, and we raised our class size. And we started by raising our class size from 125 to 150 because I wanted to see where the rub would be and whatever. And at 1 year, the 150 seemed to be working. And so then I talked to the idea. So we moved the class from 150 to about from 150 to 200. So then, in discussing the shortage in Michigan and the places we wanted to do, and I had many of my partner hospitals in the east side of the state, Detroit, all those places, and they were a real issue. And so we began to talk about opening a campus on the east side of the state. And after a long discussion, we wound up not opening one campus, we opened two, one in Macomb and one downtown Detroit, midtown Detroit. And so we have one class, now 300, 315 students a year, with three locations. And in that, we learned a lot. We've built the largest synchronous distance education operation on the North American continent. Everything I lecture in Detroit or everything I lecture in Macomb, everything I lecture here is immediately real-time available to everybody at all three of those sites.
Looking out ahead, as Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine, what major changes do you foresee in medical training for these next generations of physicians?
Well, relatively easy to think about. I think in the next 10 years, maybe 15 for sure, genetics will become a huge issue. It's already becoming that, but it's going to be even bigger.
Dr. William Strample is the Dean of MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine. Dr. Strample, thank you for talking with me.
Anytime.
For Current State, I'm Joe Lindstroth.
Well, 50 years ago today, America's historic journey with the automobile took an adventurous detour.
Coming April 17th, the unexpected, the new Ford Mustang, brilliant new kind of car. A new generation of Fords for the new breed of Americans who want stick-shift action and room for four, who collect sports car badges and trading stamps, who want the elegance of a European touring car and, till now, had to settle for basic transportation. This is for them. This is Mustang.
Yes, on April 17th, 1964, Detroit's Ford Motor Company unveiled the Mustang at the New York World's Fair, trading stamps not included. Billed as the country's first affordable sporty car, the Mustang was among the first in a new generation of smaller, sleeker passenger cars, pony cars, that would soon be joined by imitators like the Chevrolet Camaro and the Pontiac Firebird. The pioneering model has become iconic. Its rich, eventful history is explored in a new book, Mustang and the Pony Car Revolution. Its author, Michael W.R. Davis, joins us now. Welcome to Current State, Mr. Davis.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
You were working at Ford on this date 50 years ago. As you look back on a half century of the Mustang, what's uppermost in your mind?
Well, actually, while I was working at Ford, I was at Ford's in-house competitor with Ford Division, which was the source of the Mustang. I was at Lincoln Mercury then, although earlier, I'd been working at Ford Division when the crucial step of killing an alternative vehicle was done by Lee Iacocca exactly a year before. And then he told his product planners what we needed was, which was a sporty car to compete with the Chevrolet Monza. And that was, in my mind, at least the beginning of the Mustang.
I have to ask, do you remember the day? Do you remember this day 50 years ago?
Yeah, I remember the day very distinctly, but not the date.
Okay.
I had been working on, I was a PR guy, and I had been working on the press materials for this new small car called the Cardinal for several weeks. And my boss came in and sat down and lit his pipe and said, Iacocca's killing the Cardinal, and I can't say over the air what my response was, but you can imagine.
And why was the Cardinal scrapped to make way for the Mustang?
Because Iacocca perceived it as I'll shorten it and say a frumpy car, and we needed something sporty to compete with the Monza.
Sounds like something Lee Iacocca would say.
Yeah, well, it was more, a little bit more colorful.
Let's talk about the Mustang itself. As someone who has owned five different Mustangs, what stands out most about this model over 50 years? Why has it prevailed for 50 years, do you think?
Well, it's a fun car, basically. And it was very economical at the time, and it still is if you don't start adding on high-performance engines and so on. It was originally sort of an all-things-to-all-people because you could have an economy version, a performance version, or a luxury version, according to which options you chose.
Do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite of the five that you have owned?
Oh, yes. In fact, we still have it in the family. My daughter has it, my oldest daughter, which was an 84 Turbo GT convertible. And I drove it for 10 years, and then my daughter asked for it 20 years ago as a wedding present, so I fixed it up, gave it to her. She still has it.
A lot of people think of the Mustang as groundbreaking. But your book takes a real historical approach to its creation. Aside from the Cardinal, did the sportier Mustang actually have any kind of predecessor?
Well, a lot of them, and as in my view, starting with the Model T Ford Runabout, which was an economical in its time in the 1920s, a sporty. Low-priced car. In fact, it was the lowest-priced car ever mass-produced.
That was considered sporty in its time then?
Well, I don't think that word existed then, as far as I know, when applied to cars. But it was followed in the 1930s by rumble seat roadsters, which most all makers had. And that was definitely sporty. And the point is that it was not utilitarian like a station wagon, let's say, or even a plain old four-door sedan. So it was the idea of something that's just for, as it were, the ego of the driver and owner. It wasn't for carrying loads of luggage or children. It was a four-place car, so you could actually, as long as you only had two children, you were okay.
You were supposed to have fun in a Mustang, though. It was supposed to be fun to drive a Mustang. That was the point.
Yes, exactly. And then that was all... pre-war, and then including the styling of the original Lincoln Continental, which was a long hood and a short rear deck, and that definitely influenced the design, the appearance, in other words, of the Mustang when it first came out, and they've stayed to that pretty faithfully, which is among other things, which accounts for its 50 years of continuous availability.
Yeah. What was the advertising like surrounding the release of the Mustang?
Well, like all the other marketing, it was quite innovative. I didn't remember the original one that you just played on the air, the one I liked best was the one they did in 1966, the most memorable one to my way of thinking, which was Six and the Single Girl. A book had come out a few months before Sex and the Single Girl, so this was a play on it, and it was emphasizing the six-cylinder engine. So it was Six and the Single Girl, and you'd have to see it to appreciate it. You know, the not too beautiful. Young lady driving this convertible Mustang, and all the good looking guys giving her the once over.
Oh boy, I was around then. I don't remember that one, but we're talking with Mike Davis, the author of the new book Mustang and the Pony Car Revolution. Here today is the 50th anniversary of Ford's unveiling of the Mustang at the New York World's Fair. How successful were the sales of the first Mustang, Mike?
Well, they were overwhelming, far beyond anything that Ford had dreamed. And as I recall, Ford dealers took something like, either sold or took orders for 22,000 cars, Mustangs, on that opening day. First
wow.
day it was officially on sale, and it was so successful on a continuing basis that Ford had to add two additional assembly plants. The original one was in Dearborn, in the Rouge plant, Dearborn Assembly Plant. Then they added a plant in Metuchen, New Jersey, and San Jose, California, in only a few months. And to do that is a tremendous undertaking. But it was to meet the demand. And then in 2 years' time, it sold a million Mustangs were sold. Just absolutely incredible. Particularly when matched against today's numbers of the top selling cars.
I see.
For one model.
The styling of the car and the features on the car have, over 50 years, they've undergone inevitable changes. I mean, even the Mustang went through a rather clunky phase, didn't it,
yes,
for a while?
Unfortunately. Oddly enough, the car, and you're speaking of the Pinto-based Mustang, which was called the Mustang II, which was also Iacocca's inspiration, because he foresaw the need for a really more economical sporty car, and that was it from 74 through 78. And it actually initially sold very well, but the Mustang purists don't like it much.
What do you make of all the other pony cars that have come out in the aftermath of the Mustang, the Camaro and the Firebird,
right,
and all the others?
Well, only the Mustang has been continuously produced all the 50 years. Camaro was out of production for 10 years or so. The Plymouth Barracuda is no more. There's no more Plymouth, no more Barracuda, although... Chrysler does have its the Dodge Challenger is its entry in the pony car market, and Camaro came back. Pontiac is no more. Even the Mustang's so-called sister car from Lincoln Mercury is no more, because Mercury is no more. So there have been a lot of changes.
The Cougar?
Mustang is still there. Yeah, the
Cougar, yeah.
Yeah, the Cougar, right.
Now, the car, to this day, 50 years later, the car enjoys a reputation for power. I mean, there's an awful lot of horsepower that goes into the highest powered Mustang.
Well, that's right. And that's more competitive with the Chevrolet Corvette, for example. That's part of the multiple personalities of the Mustang that have evolved over the years. But even in the very beginning... there was a high-performance option offered after a few months after the car was initially introduced. You had the which was economical for the time, six-cylinder engine, which had been scavenged from the Ford Falcon, which was a compact economy car introduced for 1960. In fact, that was part of the secret of getting the car to market and with quickly and with minimal investment. Was scavenging stuff from existing cars.
You think the Mustang's good for another 50 years?
Well, who knows? The marketplace can change in an instant. And in fact, at one point, Ford was considering getting rid of the rear-wheel drive Mustang in favor of a Japanese-based front-wheel drive. And fortunately, I think the Mustang buyers didn't go for it. They and the planners realized that ahead of time, so that there was no break in the model years of Mustang.
This has been an awful lot of fun. We appreciate your time. Michael W.R. Davis is the author of the new book, Mustang and the Pony Car Revolution. It's 50 years ago today that the Mustang was unveiled at the New York World's Fair. Thanks, Mr. Davis.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yes, AC/DC Down Payment Blues there. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Now we have a book review featuring another 2014 Michigan notable book. This time, contributor Scott Southard decided to read a collection of short stories and poems featuring Michigan's Upper Peninsula. He offers these thoughts on The Way North.
Reviewing a literary collection can feel a lot like reviewing a local talent show. It can be hard to sum up the entire experience, since every act is unique, and it is unfair to compare the performers to each other, even though we all do it, no matter what the focus of the talent show is or the age of those involved. And like that talent show, literary collections tend to have their writers who take your breath away and make you lean forward in your chair, as well as the ones who make you wonder what you're missing on TV. The Way North is a collection showcasing some of the leading voices in the Upper Peninsula literary movement. This 2014 Michigan Notable book was edited by playwright Ron Rieke and includes more than 40 Michigan poets and writers. Putting together a show like this with this many performers must have been quite a Herculean task for our director. My favorite short story was The Possibility of Wolves by Sharon Dilworth. It's a tale so rich in possibility that it's almost too bad it is only a short story. The Possibility of Wolves is about the only professional clown in the UP and his failing marriage. Yannick the clown believes he is the master of secrets, but his wife has a better secret, and her secret beats out any that he thinks he may have kept from her. My favorite character was from the short story Tug by Janice Ripka. Nana is a double amputee and diabetic who still likes to stealthily eat marshmallow peeps when no one is looking. She makes the mistake of reading her granddaughter's journal, which leads to an interesting moral dilemma. The odd story in the collection is Mezzanotte by John Smolens, about a missing college student in Italy. And while it doesn't fit in with the rest of the acts, I appreciated the change in scenery, even though it was jarring to have that shift. It must have been hard for Rieke to say no to such a story. See, the one common theme, save that excellent escape to Italy, is the Upper Peninsula, and the focus in each of the stories and poems seems to be on creating that distinct UP atmosphere and vibe, as opposed to plot. Because of that choice, the audience would not be moved to tears, and there would probably be no laughter up and down the aisles. It's just not that kind of show. In the end, the book feels almost more like something academic, a classroom assignment maybe, as compared to an evening's entertainment built for applause. So while it is not Broadway bound, it is a fine collection and a nice introduction to this distinct Michigan literary movement. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
And Scott's the author of two novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth in the Case of the Dangerous Dare. His writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. A quick reminder that next Tuesday is Earth Day, and your contribution to WKAR in any amount can make our Earth greener, in addition to bringing you programs like Current State that you depend on throughout the year. Your Earth Day contribution to WKAR will also help plant trees here in mid-Michigan. Join us Tuesday for a special Earth Day celebration, or you can give right now. Just go to WKAR.org. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll learn about a water purification system built by MSU students that could help people from around the world, and live music from the DeCamp Sisters tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.